Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Thank you, Les. It's a real honor to be here and to be speaking in a temple that you've kept alive for decades. And I'm very honored to be here. Is anybody here for the first time, or has everybody been here? First time. Welcome. It's good to have you here. Did I see another hand? You too? Great. Well, welcome. It's good to have you here. We have a saying, a statement, a phrase that we use, which is beginner's mind. And I thought that that meant that the temple at San Francisco Zen Center, City Center, which is called Beginner's Mind Temple, I thought that's where everybody started practice, because that was the beginner's temple. But later I found a little bit deeper into this statement, and that is the mind that we want to be approaching the moment that we're in with. When you're a beginner, there is a certain openness that you have. And so with the three of you tonight, this is literally the first time you're here. And so it is of that mind that we are trying to approach practice, from the mind of what is here in this moment that I can be open to, that I can learn. And one question that might be asked then is, why here? Why at this temple? Why sitting? In these times, when I say these times, it seems as though there is a lot of need for people to be doing good things in this world. There seems to be a need for taking action, for standing up for things, for helping to build things. And this can seem passive, sitting. One person even said to me one time when I told them I had done a few practice periods at Tassajara, he said, I would love to do that, but it just seems too self-indulgent. So what is it that we are doing here in these times? There are plenty of places that could use our time, our focus, and our energy. So I want to start off with an analogy that I think everyone will relate to on some level, either with some sense of craving or aversion, and that is ice cream. Now, there might be somebody here who doesn't like ice cream or who doesn't eat it anymore, and I'm not trying to tempt anyone, but this is something that I really enjoyed my whole life. And when I was 5 years old, there was probably nothing more powerful than promising that you would give me ice cream. And my grandfather, he used to take me and get me ice cream, even though he wasn't allowed to eat it on his diet anymore. And grandma knew that, so he would take me out to get ice cream, and he wouldn't buy me one ice cream. He'd buy me two ice creams. So I had two ice creams, and my grandpa had no ice cream. And then he would ask me if he could have a bite of my ice cream. And so that's how my grandpa and I would have ice cream. And of course, we would tell grandma that grandpa had bought no ice cream for grandpa. Now, it was not that much of a veiled secret. Grandma knew what was going on. But he would give me ice cream. And then if there was ever a time where I was having ice cream and the ice cream would fall, in fact, there was even one occasion where I dropped my ice cream. Now, you know what it's like to be disappointed in traffic, in a meeting, at home, with a loved one. You know what it's like to have an expectation for what's going to happen next, and maybe it just doesn't happen. But when you are five and that expectation is ice cream, the world has ended. There is no more world. Because your perspective and your capacity to hold what is going on when you are five and you're thinking of ice cream is only as big as that ice cream. You would push a button and end the world. Your toys don't exist. Your parents don't exist. All that exists is that ice cream. That's all that you have the bandwidth for at that time, is that ice cream. Now, at some point, we grow up, as we call it, we grow up, and we have a little bit bigger perspective on ice cream. Now, you might like ice cream, and maybe I've said that word too much, so I'm not trying to tempt anybody, but we all like something, and if that's something, that little thing, whether it be our favorite drink or our favorite food, isn't something that we get to eat because we dropped it on the ground, we aren't going to want to end the world. Now, we'll feel maybe a twinge inside, like, oh, that was a nice cappuccino. Or, oh, I really wanted to engage with this. But there is something that has expanded, where your perspective of the world has grown to a place where you don't know why it grew. You didn't have a project plan from when you were five. Okay, I'm going to have a way in which I can accept the fact that ice cream disappointment has now been able to be held. And now I am 30 years old. Now I'm 50 years old. And I can handle that. There wasn't any plan. There's something that happened with your perspective that unfolded over this period of time. And so we've all experienced an expansion in some sort of way since we were 5 years old. It just feels different. You know what it's like when something doesn't go your way, okay? How much space does the five-year-old have for anybody else to be imperfect? The emotional reservoir at that point is full. Now, if that happens to a 25-year-old, chances are there's a little bit more that exists in the world than just ice cream at that point. And there still is space for the person next to them to not be perfect. And this phenomena is something that humans have noticed over a long period of time that has to do with the capacity that we have to be in the moment that is right now, without being overwhelmed by it, by being able to be in that moment as it is happening. Now, it's not that you aren't disappointed in the ice cream or sad, but when you're 25, there's something that else, there's room for something else in that emotional reservoir that can still go in there. Something has expanded. Through this practice, there is an expansion, an infinite inward expansion of that emotional reservoir, of that psychic view, of that capacity to hold, that allows the things to be held in a way that it doesn't crush you the way that it maybe did in the past. How this actually works, no one really knows. But we know the effect. We know the effect of practice. We know the effect of being in an acceptance practice of what is happening right now. Around the same time that the Buddha was in the Indo-Gangetic plain, there was a philosopher named Plato in Greece who was writing the allegory of the cave. And in the allegory of the cave, people are trapped around a cave wall because there is a monster. And they can't go around the cave wall, they can't leave the cave, because this monster will eat them, at least according to their mythology. And they have spun the tales, and the tales have grown larger and larger about what this monster is and what it will do to you and all the rest of it, to the point that people are trapped in fear. They are unsettled. They are not calm. And when you are not calm and you are not settled, you come up with mythologies about what is going on in the world around you. And you react to people in your personal life, you react to people in the world at work, in reflex to what you have digested inside. Now, how calm is that 5-year-old that just dropped their ice cream? There isn't a lot of rationality. You aren't going to be able to talk about something in that state. And you can think of the person in your life, or persons, that you have had the hardest time being calm with. A roommate, someone in your family, someone in your sangha, someone at work, someone in your neighborhood. And you've been in that conversation. You know that conversation where there is no more oxygen in the conversation? All the molecules are just like touching each other and you really can't quite think. You can't think clearly and they're saying words and it seems like that there isn't any space for you to even think thoughts because their mouth is moving. And you want to be able to say something. And you want to be able to think clearly, but the good thought that you're going to think of tomorrow that you should have said to them isn't necessarily popping into your head right now. You aren't that clear. You aren't that calm. We know what this sort of experience is like as human beings, and people have been looking at this for a long period of time. How come sometimes I am trapped around the cave wall like the people in Plato's allegory of the cave. And for whatever reason, I am certain that I can't leave the cave. Now, of course, in Plato's allegory of the cave, there is someone who goes around the cave wall and actually looks directly at the monster. And there isn't actually a monster. There's just a mouse with a light source up on the wall. The illusion of danger, if you will. And so we sit in Zazen. We sit in this practice in this room with what comes up, with our mythology, with our story, with how we have digested it, with our neurobiology, as it is unfolding moment after moment after moment. And as it unfolds, we are sitting right between two things that we almost always do as human beings in our daily life as we function. And that is, you ever play the game at the fair called whack-a-mole? So whack-a-mole is like the mole comes up, and maybe that's not politically correct to be whacking moles these days, I don't know. Moles would probably be upset about this. But there's this game, whack-a-mole, and the mole comes up, and you have a paddle. And as soon as the mole comes up, you have to go, no, no. No, no, no. Keeping down all the things that does not make Michael feel beautiful, strong, and brave. No, no, no. Keep that down. The stuff that winds me up, that, oh, no, I can't think about that. Or, no, that's not a problem. No, no. And then there's the other game, which is chasing shiny objects, which is what squirrels do. You know, you give a shiny object to a squirrel, and that's how you trap a squirrel, is you put a shiny object in a little space in a tree that's just a little bit bigger than the object, and then the squirrel can't get its hand out. And we all know what it's like to be that squirrel at 10 o'clock at night, ruminating on a subject that we can't let go of, about that thing that person said, and we should have said that other thing. And I know how come they said that thing, because their mother is kind of like this sort of person, and, you know, all of that story. Or the shiny object that's fun to think about. You know, tonight when I leave here, the person was talking about ice cream. I'm going to get ice cream. I wonder if they have that. So there's the fun thing that we think about, and there's the ruminating thing that we think about, the shiny object. And then there's whack-a-mole, all the other stuff that we're keeping away from ourselves. So in Zazen, we're sitting right in between whack-a-mole and chasing shiny objects. I'm sitting here, and someone's face comes up. That's all that happened. I'm just sitting here, and all of a sudden, you know, someone's face comes up. It's the face of this person who said that thing to me 2 weeks ago. And that's all that happened. That's all that happened. Oh, and there was a little twinge in my chest. Face popped up, twinge in my chest. That was literally the psychic and physical phenomena of what happened. Face popped up, twinge in the chest. But what I'm inclined to do most usually, if I'm not sitting zazen, is to label, okay, that's person X, and then to at least replay the loop of what happened. Okay, they said this thing. And then usually it's the loop about how I was right, how they shouldn't have said that thing, or even if they were right, they were right in the wrong way. And so then I've got this shiny object that I'm turning over. Now maybe I realize that, and the person's face pops up, and I start to analyze it. Oh, I think that I always am worried about this person because of this other thing, and okay, I'm telling a story. I'm in the allegory of the cave. I'm telling a story about the face and why it popped up. Or I play whack-a-mole and I push it away. No, mm-mm, no, no, we aren't going to think about that. That winds me up. Nope. How courageous is it to sit right there with just the phenomena of that twinge in my chest and the person's face popped up? Because that's all that happened. That was the psychic phenomenon. That's what happened in front of me. That's what happened inside me. And can I do neither of those two things? Can I not wish that, okay, as soon as that face goes away, as soon as that phenomena goes away in my chest, I'm going to get back to the Zen stuff, back when I was calm. Can I let that just be there as it is and not chase it away? And not hold on to it and make it stay any longer than it wants to? Can I be right with the thing that's happening? It is an acceptance practice that we are doing. When we say practice, you know, like you practice for the violin, you practice for the big play, you practice for basketball, you practice for life with your story in zazen. Bless you. And the practice goes, of course, beyond zazen. We use the phrase taking the practice off of the cushion into our life. The reason we design these rooms and we have these cushions and we have the blank wall is that it's easier to at least start to see what's going on when we have a little bit fewer distractions. So we all come into this room and there is an agreement that we aren't going to talk to each other and we're going to try not to move and we're going to try to be quiet, so that Michael can see his story and you can see your story. And so we can sit here in this room and we are working on that allegory of the cave. Can I have the courage to be right there with the thing that's happening as it's happening and let it unfold? Because we know what the scariest thing to do that happens to our psyche when we are, three, and we think there's a monster under the bed. I mean, the scariest thing you can do is to just pull the covers up higher and leave the light off. The most courageous thing you can do is to get the covers down, walk across your room, turn on the light, go back, get a flashlight, stare under your bed, look right at the thing that you think is happening without adding any story to it. Let's just look under the bed. And so we come here and we look, and we have the courage to be with our body, with the phenomena that's going on, and with the things that are unfolding right in front of us. It's an acceptance practice. It's not an approval practice. It's an acceptance practice. It is being right with what's happening. Not so that you can just sit idly by on the city bus or at work and not take any action ever because you just sit there and you just accept everything as it's unfolding. No. But how will we know when to act unless we have settled, unless we are calm and clear, unless we have some sort of way in which we have, over a period of time, learned how to settle a little bit? How calm and clear was the 5-year-old that lost their ice cream? Nothing else exists. How calm and clear am I when I'm in that conversation with that person in my family, or in that person at work, or that person in my neighborhood that bothers me, and I am not calm? How well do I actually make decisions? How well do I actually know when to act, when to speak, when not to speak? I don't know. And so we have this practice. This practice where we are coming into a place where we can be with our movie as it's unfolding, moment by moment. Like we're in a room, like we're in our room, like we're at our dinner table, like it is a party at our house, and we didn't write the guest list. And the front door is open, and the back door is open, and people are coming in. And we don't waste any emotional energy wishing that one person would stay a little bit longer and trying to get them to stay at the party and trying to usher other people out a little sooner because we wish they didn't come to the party. We don't waste any emotional energy. We're just sitting here learning to see what is going on. But we're looking and being right here with what's going on with curiosity, without the discursive analytical mind, without picking it apart and trying to quantify it. Oh, that person's face popped up yesterday, and it popped up the day before, and I want, no. We all know what it's like to look at something and to just hold it outside of language without it analyzing it. I mean, when you see a beautiful moon outside, you do not say to yourself in the analytical brain, Michael, that is a beautiful moon. No, I usually just look at the moon. You just take it in. It's just the experience of the moon. When the experience happens in Zazen, can we do the same sort of thing with curiosity? Person's face pops up, twinge in the chest. Can I be right there with it, with curiosity? Not analysis, with acceptance. I didn't choose for that phenomenon to happen. That wasn't a plan. I didn't summon it. That is what I inherited in that moment. And if I can sit there with curiosity, I might learn a little bit about what's going on in here over time. And not just learn as in the word learn in the cognitive understanding, you know, erudite sort of sense, school learning, the learning that is an understanding that goes deeper. The understanding that you see when a painter is looking with curiosity as the painting is unfolding. A bad painter will look at a painting and say, I know exactly how I'm going to paint that painting. A good painter will notice as they are painting the way that the colors and the paint is thick or runny, the way that the canvas is taut or loose, the way that it's unfolding, and they'll be with it as it is unfolding with curiosity, because it can't become what it's going to become without that openness to the unfolding that's happening right now in front of me. We could be doing a lot of other things tonight, and there could be a lot of other places that could use our help. Why would we come and sit and be still and look at a wall? Because the world is full of people, and I am a person, and you are a person. And every single one of us knows what it is like to be with that person that is not the person that is tight, but the person that is loose, that has space, that their emotional reservoir for me, for you. You think of that person in your life, someone who you felt like you could make mistakes around. who felt like they were calm with you, who was spacious with you, who was encouraging. And we know what it's like to be around a person whose emotional reservoir is full. How easy is it for you to be you? How easy is it for you to be creative? How easy is it for you to share, to risk, to trust? What if each of us could give the world the gift of us being a little bit more calm, a little bit more clear, an emotional reservoir that had a little bit more space? I think that going out and doing things that are active in this world and are politically motivated, socially motivated, environmentally motivated, getting involved with many different things, helping work with ways in which businesses can be more empowering. And there's so many things you can do. The world is infinite with problems. But I'll never forget the story that Blanche Hartman, our first abbess of San Francisco Zen Center, told us one time about her activism in the late 60s. And she realized she had been an activist also in the civil rights movement down in the South. And she was active in the civil rights movement in the Bay Area. And she realized during one protest over in Berkeley, while she was running, while she was walking and shouting, that she inside was feeling really angry and kind of overwhelmed and very much full of the feeling of us and them, us and them. The vision was getting blurred. Me and my team, we understand. And the other team, not so sure they understand. And she took a year and a half, I think, or 2 years off where she didn't do any politically active events. And she sat with that inside, with what was the phenomenon that was going on inside for her. Very intentionally looking at the disturbance, not with analysis, but with acceptance, with the curious artist mind, letting it unfold on the wall in front of her. This is creating a safe space for people to come and learn to be with this one. To be a better mother, sister, brother, boss, manager, employee, citizen. So that the people around you feel that spaciousness to be themselves, to feel empowered to bring their gift out to the world. It's an acceptance practice, not an approval practice. You know, if you have a baby and the baby is 9 months old and you need to go to Whole Foods to get frozen peas, and you walk into the frozen food section, and because of all of the noises of the fans and the coldness, the baby starts to cry. Now, you don't approve. Yay, baby, keep crying. That's great. But there is this acceptance. There is this understanding that the baby did not get here through any project plan to be crying in Whole Foods at age 9 months. And you did not come up with a project plan to have the phenomenon that you had in your body, in your mind, when you were looking at that wall. You came to that moment, and there you were in that moment. So we're not approving of, yay, I want to feel angry, jealous, hateful, petty. But chances are you didn't have a plan to arrive at that place either. And can you hold that softly the way that you hold a baby? Can we engage it the way that you would hold something that you are totally accepting of? You aren't going to go into the discursive analytical mind with a 9-month-old and start to say, you know, this is the reason for the fans and this is whatever, and start picking it apart. You don't go there. It's not going to do any good. And you are not going to talk yourself out of feeling the way that you feel. But can you hold the baby gently? Can you sit in Zazen with the courage to be there as it unfolds in front of you and hold the baby gently with acceptance. Yes, this is what's happening. This is who came to the party. This is who popped up in my head. That's the phenomenon I had in my chest. And with curiosity, just sit there. Just sit there. Because 5 months from now, 5 years from now, that person in your family, that person in your life, that person at work, where there was no oxygen in the conversation and there was no loosening, all of a sudden you might notice one day in a conversation that you have maybe some molecules of empathy crawling into that conversation. You might have some calming. There might be some settledness. You don't know how it happened, but the container might have gotten a little bit bigger. Some of my most encouraging days in practice have been walking away from a conversation that was a little bit fraught or tense, and just knowing in my body, wow, I think that's only going to ruin the next 10 or 15 minutes. That used to ruin like the whole day. Something happened to the half-life of bother. It's dissipating in a way that it didn't before. I don't know when I left Kansas, but something is just not like it used to be. It's that phenomena in our practice that we are appreciative for. But there aren't any goals or destinations. We don't know how to untie this knot. But we engage in practice because we want to be a part of the solution in this world. And it starts with us. It starts with how I hold things. I can spend the rest of my life trying to be forced nice with an emotional reservoir that's overflowing. And everybody knows what it's like to be forced nice, where your emotional reservoir is full, but you are kind of done with everything you can hold. And everything else that happens next that's not perfect is stress. And it's really hard to be in that body, in that mind, when you're existing in that way. And it's really hard to be spacious for the people around you. And so we probably all grew a bit since we were 5 years old with our ice cream. But that same phenomena is still available to us with all of the other things that overwhelm us. Exactly how it will unfold for each person, at what rate, who knows? We all have our unique koan. We all have our unique story that's unfolding in front of us. But if we can be open and embrace that story as it's unfolding, we can be a part of the solution that we want to be in the world. And this here in this room, this is people coming and practicing for being that person in the world. The people had the courage to turn on the light and to look under the bed directly at the monster. And to hold it the way that we would hold whatever we see underneath the bed, that we have some sort of way that we will hold it that is with acceptance and like we would hold a baby. There's an author that I love. Many of you might be familiar with Rilke. And someone read this quote years ago to me right after I was feeling like I was feeling frustrated because I did not have an answer. And oftentimes when I sit zazen and I'm troubled by something, what I want is I love to analyze things and do self-help, figure them out and know what to do next. You know, I'm a project planner and I want to get from A to B, figure it out. This is what we're going to do. So Zen, I thought, was like a great thing for me because I'm like, wow, I can never figure this out. And you have to let it unfold. You know, if you ever watch corn grow on time lapse, you know, it's just, you know, it's all over the place. And it's kind of like corn. It's kind of like crops that grows at its own pace, at its own rate. And whether or not things will loosen a little bit for me, I've noticed has a lot to do with how it's being held, whether I'm tight around it or whether I am spacious around it, whether I can let it unfold with some curiosity or whether or not I am trying to use the discursive mind to analyze it, pick it apart, and say exactly how this will be. And you can do that with a lot of things in life. But if you're trying to morph something in a spiritual path that has to do with a body and a mind, you have limited how far you can go if the project plan was written by that body and that mind. It inherently has to have faith in something bigger than itself, or it's limited to what is pragmatic to that body and mind. And so we engage in something that is bigger than ourselves, and we let it unfold with curiosity. And don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with using our minds to figure things out. But that can't be the limit or the highest peak of what it is that we are engaging in, is what seems smart or right to me today. I mean, if that was true, then I would have most of my answers. And if that's not true, then the answers that I'm looking for, in many cases, might seem weird, strange, odd, or outright wrong. Can I be open to things as they unfold in front of me? This is from Rainier Maria Rilke from Letters to a Young Poet. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves. Like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue, do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Thank you all. And Les, do we do questions and answers, or do we end, or what do we do?
We have time for some questions and answers.
Okay. Do we have any answers or any questions?
This may sound like a kind of a newbie question, but some things that I enjoy that keep my mind focused are hiking or like ceramics. And it's very obvious, there's obvious feedback when my mind starts to wander, such as when I'm going downhill and my mind starts to wander, I slip and fall, or I'm throwing a pot, it goes off balance. So one thing I have a challenge with is with sitting, like I try to focus on my posture or breathing, but there's not a lot of feedback. So I'm just wondering, from your own personal experience, when you started sitting, did you struggle with that?
Thank you for. I really liked how you unpacked that, because it's a central thing that people ask, and I think ask until they are done practicing. You know, I think that the you know, what I'm hearing you ask is, how do I know in Zazen when I've thrown a pot that went askew? You know, what is the feedback that is going off course? Now, here's there's a context for this, and that is that if you were going downhill and you made and you weren't, let's say, paying attention, there's consequences when you will, you know, fall. So you've probably heard of the breathing practice where you breathe and count to 10. You know, now I don't know if for you started out counting to 10 and you just got to 10 and you never lost your way. But I lost my way all the time when I first started, and I still lose my way. You know, I'll try to go to 10, I'll get to 8, I'll be off in the weeds thinking about a sandwich. I'm like, oh, wait. And then I come back. And so the first way, as far as, you know, how do you know when maybe you stumbled, is the intention is to follow your breath. Okay? Now, the one distinction to make is that if you step on a rut when you are walking downhill, that you might twist your ankle, you might get injured. Okay? If I am counting my breath and I get to six, and then all of a sudden I start thinking, you know, about how I need to mow the lawn, and then I'm thinking about how I need to, you know, and I'm like, oh, wait a second, where was I? What number? Okay. Did I do it wrong? Am I not sitting zazen? Did I twist my ankle, so to speak? Well, no. That's part of what you're watching, is the wander. And so let's say yesterday you got to eight continuously, and today you've only got to four over and over again. Are you doing it worse? No. There's a million things that could be happening in your life, what you ate, what's going to happen later today, how well you slept. And then also, it's like an archaeological dig. You'll find that like 10 years down the road, the stuff that you're sitting with, maybe you weren't even aware of 10 years previous, and you're only getting to four. So it's impossible to quantify exactly what four even means. But you set an intention, and whatever that intention is, and then you notice when you aren't with that intention, and then you accept the fact that that's what's going on. No analysis, no criticism, like, oh, I'm so unfocused, nobody in my family's focused, how come, you know, it's like, no. All I do, it's the acceptance practice, is I go back to one. So that's why I go back to one. Without any analysis, I just go back to one. So anytime that you notice that your intention, like your intention could be to sit and to not move, but then all of a sudden you lose your way and you scratch your eyebrow. Well, is that sitting zazen? Well, of course it's sitting zazen. It wasn't what your intention was, but it's also a teacher. You're like, oh, that wasn't my intention. Okay, go back to the immovable sitting school. And so anytime that you notice what you're not doing what your intention is, that's when you would have, like, you know, stumbled or not been in the flow, if you will. But it's also still the Zen thing. It's still the teacher. And that's why you're in a safe space with that. Does that help?
Yes.
Thank you.
Hey, Michael. I just really want to thank you for your talk, first of all. It resonated with me a lot. And I don't have a direct question, but I just kind of want to share where I'm at, and then maybe you'll have advice, I don't know. So the part that really resonated with me was about wanting to be part of the solution, not seeing how to untangle the knot, and also the part about realizing my reservoir had gotten too full, kind of like what you shared about Blanche and being an activist, and then realizing I'm getting very angry, I'm getting very stressed, I'm getting like to where I'm seeing too many upsetting things. And so I've already had the realization that I needed to relax the grip a little bit, take a step back, take time for myself, take care of myself so that I have more space in my reservoir to sort of get some of that cleaned out. So that's good. But I guess the kind of analogy is like, let's say I did the courageous thing and I got out of bed and turned on the light and I'm like, there's probably no monster there. And I pull up the covers and I'm like, there is a monster there. There's a monster under my bed. There's something malicious in my life, like out to harm me in my space. How do I deal with this? Like, I'm committed to having a, you know, safe and compassionate and peaceful life, and there's a little monster under my bed, you know, wreaking havoc, eating the food in my cupboards, trashing my house kind of thing. It's more at work than at home, to be honest. But, you know, like, there's kind of these chaos mongers, and I also understand that what's going on, what I'm seeing, is coming from a place of fear. You know, why would someone be attacking me unless they're afraid of me, right? But then that's where I'm at, like, okay, have some space, have some curiosity, but I have no idea how this is going to work out, you know? So what I am doing is doing my best to have like a stable mind and realize, well, in perspective, no one's going to die. You know, I could change jobs, or I could, and like, no one's going to die. It's not the end of the world. So that's been good. But also it's like, well, if this situation's unfolding in my life, it must be that I'm supposed to learn something or I'm supposed to do something with it. So I'm kind of in this limbo of, I don't know what I'm supposed to do about this, but I want to be part of the solution.
Well, thank you. I wonder how many people have that same sort of question about their workplace in Silicon Valley. What happens when we have something that is... it's like the iron ball that gets stuck in our throat where we can't swallow it and we can't spit it out, you know. I think there's an illusion at times when we feel stuck that there's nothing we can do. Even though cognitively we might actually feel like there's something we can do, there probably is something that we can do. But the emotion of stuck, oftentimes, it has the feeling of being encased in cement, like there isn't anything I can do. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience on a cold day with a knot, where you try to undo your boots or you try to undo your shoes, and it's one of those days where it's below freezing, and you pull the shoe the string the wrong way, and you actually create a knot as opposed to untie your shoes, and it's cold, and you feel like this is never going to come undone, you know, and then you work on the knot. From different angles, your fingers and fingernails get sore, you know, and you're just about to give up when a little tiny budge happens. You're like, oh, you know, that feeling just kind of goes through you, like, oh, this might move. And it's amazing in those stuck places how much of that place comes with a momentum and a feeling that becomes the place itself. And if there can be movement in a direction that feels like there might be change, it is amazing what that can do for someone's spirit. And, you know, I know we're just talking in generalities here. But whatever the context is, what is it that I control? You know, can I focus on things that I'm grateful for? Can I empower somebody in this situation? Can I look for things that are intentionally are two circles and they overlap 3%? But here's the 3% I can focus on. Is there anything that I can do at home that rejuvenates my spirit? What is it that I do where I feel like I am alive? Can I make sure that I do that once a day? You know, it's like going through all the things that you might have some control over and then trying to see if you get that spark in that knot. It's amazing sometimes how, you know, they have that, the little tiny bit that can change, can change everything, you know? And then what if there's a little tiny change tomorrow, you know? Being loose with yourself first, spacious with yourself first, realizing that there's plenty of things in each of our lives that we don't handle well, that we haven't figured out how to handle. And can we... allow ourselves to do our best without also having to fight our own monster of I'm not fighting it well enough. And that's an infinite regression. So, you know, that's, I know a lot of generalities, but how you hold yourself in that and what you focus on that you can do might change how that feels. Thank you. Les, are we at the time? I don't want to run over.
We have time for one more.
Okay. Thank you for your talk, Michael. What you said about some days you count to 10, some days you count to 8, sometimes you only make it to 4. There was a wonderful guest speaker, actually, at our previous Zendo many years ago, Alan Liu, and he was talking about that phenomenon of suddenly realizing that you didn't make it to 10. And he said it's absolutely essential that you don't sort of get down on yourself about that. That, I mean, in the immortal words of Britney Spears, oops, I did it again, right? Slap yourself on the wrist, you know, bad meditator, bad meditator. He said, the thing to say at that point is, I'm back. And he really regarded that moment as being sort of the heart and soul of Zazen. It's when you come back. I did have a question, actually, though. You were talking about when something arises, you want to sit with it, not get lost in it, the shiny object, not push it away, play whack-a-mole, but just let it arise and sit with it. But also, you want to say, I'm back. And returning to your breath and sitting with the thing that arose don't seem like they're exactly the same thing, but they don't seem inherently incompatible either. Could you just say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, the sitting with the thing that is arising is it's the movie on the wall that as it's playing. And so I'm not going to stop it, but I'm also not going to summon more. And over time, it might fade, or it might, hang out for a shorter period of time, or what have you. But I don't want to go to war with myself. And so, there's two things going on here. One is if you're number counting your breath and going physically, breathing in one, breathing out one, all the rest of it, you will have that's a bit of an anchor. And so that's where we start out in sitting in the temples, and it's where they start you out in Japan, is they breathe in one, breathe out one, okay? And as you are anchoring yourself in your breath, it's the acceptance practice of going back to number one. I haven't heard of introducing a phrase like, I'm back. I've just been told, just go back. To stay out of language and to just go back to one and keep breathing. Now, with the shikantaza, if you will, the just sitting, that would be complete objectless sitting without even using the breath as an anchor, without even counting the breath. You might notice the breath, but you are just sitting and letting the phenomena arise moment after moment after moment. And with that, you are more susceptible to what's happening with the front door open and the back door open with the party. That it's just, you know, you're noticing the breath, you're noticing the body, but you're not directing the mind to a specific thing. You're letting the whole phenomena of everything that's in this experience arise moment after moment after moment. And so that is the objectless sitting that would be the traditional shikantaza. But most monasteries will start people out with following their breath and counting their breath. And you will still have things pop up in your periphery while you're counting your breath. And then if you get off of the counting your breath, you just go back to one. But there is a... I guess you'd say, I don't know if you'd say a transition, but there is definitely a difference between anchoring yourself with numbers and sitting without numbers and without an intentional anchor. And so I think that's where sometimes the disconnect comes in the discussion of the Zazen unfolding, if you will. Does that make sense? Well, thank you all very much. This has been a real delight to be here. What an attentive crowd and a beautiful Zendo. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.